This is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with Tim Henney. For many young boys, there continues to be a very small space they can occupy to be considered traditionally, quote-unquote, masculine. And that small space can be restricting, forcing boys to lose what doesn't fit inside it. In his new book, How to Raise a Boy, Michael Reichert calls that space the man box. Reichert is a psychologist who specializes in boys and men. He's the founding director of the Center for the Study of Boys and Girls' Lives at the University of Pennsylvania. His book is written as a guide to parents who want to create more space for their boys to express themselves. The key, he writes, is a relationship in which a boy can tell that he matters. A young man's self-confidence is not accidental or serendipitous, he says, but derives from experiences of being accurately understood, loved, and supported. Dr. Michael Reichert, welcome to The Mountain Life. It's great to have you.
Nice to be with you, Lynn and Tim, and nice to be with your listeners in Park City.
You are the parent of boys. I'm the parent of boys. Tim is the parent of a boy. And, you know,
I
was thinking that, in fact, I was saying this to my husband this morning. The bottom line is this, that we didn't feel that we raised our boys any differently than we would have raised girls. Yet somehow they turned out different. And in the way that they're not as open, it takes them a lot to crack their shells, shall we say, to get them to talk about feelings and emotions. And I'm just wondering where that path diverges if we are the type of parents that think that we would raise girls and boys the same.
Yeah, it's a great question, and it's certainly one that all of us parents of boys have wrestled with. Let me maybe begin my answer by telling you about a study that was done by a wonderful psychologist who's currently at Stanford University, Judy Chu. For her doctoral study, she studied under Carol Gilligan at Harvard. She embedded for 2 years with four-year-old boys at a school, so from age 4 to age 6. And what she found was that originally, when she first met the boys at age 4, they were direct, they were authentic, they had language for feelings, they could connect. They were themselves. But over the course of the next 2 years, they changed, some rather dramatically, as they absorbed the cultural norms for how they were expected to be as males. They became less direct. They went behind a mask. They became less willing to reveal what they were feeling, and their whole attitude, the way they dressed, the way they walked, what the toys they played with, the kinds of games they played, all of those changed, often to the detriment of their happiness and their humanity. They even formed themselves into what they called a mean team and began to harass girls. Now, the question might arise, you know, was that just the expression of their hormones kicking in? Their biology was driving them in this more aggressive, less expressive, less civil direction? Or was that something about the masculine norms that were built into boyhood and that were urging them, requiring them to perform conventional masculinity or get punished by a peer policing, posse? And you know, her view of things, and it's a very, very considered analysis of her data, her view was that the boys were forced into these roles by the culture, and the messages were coming from everywhere, including from their parents. So I guess the point I would make to your question, and as a parent myself, I say this with a lot of sympathy and empathy, is that we can't really expect to raise our sons in a way that spares them exposure to these cultural norms that are so profound and so powerful. The better course of action, and this is what I argue in the book, is to build up their resistance to those norms by deepening our connection to them, the mantra that I like is every boy known and loved. To really know a boy, to really create the conditions in the relationship that allow that boy to show who he is and what he's really feeling. I think that's the primary work of building boys' resistance.
That's nice. Every boy known and loved. And so it makes me wonder if on the most subtle of terms or words used or ways that we direct our boys, that unconsciously somehow we are interjecting. And I'm thinking about when boys express emotions, those four-year-old boys, we might not think that we are squelching them, but there may be somewhere in there that we're suggesting they not be a crybaby or something like that. Is it that simple that we're reprogramming how they act and how they express their emotion?
Well, of course it's that simple. That's really the point. You know, it's simple, but it's profound.
Yes.
We, one of the most basic, long-standing concepts in social psychology is what's called the looking glass model of self-concept. So basically, I am who I think others see me as. If I notice that my mom or my dad or my teacher or my coach becomes uncomfortable when I show that I'm scared or uncertain or unhappy, I'm going to pick up the message that this is not how I should be, who I should be, and I'm going to shape myself, the public presentation of who I am, to fit the reflection that I'm getting. We find, for example, in schools, in education, we find that boys are surprisingly vulnerable, dependent on the connections they have with a teacher. But my partner and I, when we did the research behind that finding, we surveyed boys in 18 different schools in 6 different countries, about 1,500 adolescent boys and 1,000 of their teachers. My partner and I had between us probably at that point 50 years of experience with boys in different educational and clinical contexts. And yet the two of us were completely surprised by how relationally dependent the boys in that study revealed themselves to be. That fact that we were surprised and that the teachers in the survey themselves didn't name boys as relational learners, it was the boys themselves that identified themselves that way so clearly. So I guess the point I'm making is that we're all laboring in a fog of stereotype and myth when it comes to understanding the true nature of boys and men. And those stereotypes and myths are very consequential.
Michael, that's a perfect segue into what I am curious about and want to get your thoughts on, because I'm wondering how these stereotypes and myths came to be, because I would imagine, since they have become part of the cultural norms that we're talking about right now, that at some point they must have served a purpose to put boys in a boy box and create and build the boy into the man that we see today, which we are trying to deconstruct and disrupt and allow for alternate options. But there must have been some reason at some point that we created, you know, the model that we're living with today and the consequences of it.
Yeah, Tim, it's a very thoughtful question. First I want to say that the design of boyhood, the traditional masculinity that we have reproduced from one generation to the next, I think through the whole of human history, until now, I think that history, that traditional set of norms has already been disrupted by the women's movement and the blessings of gender equality. So, you know, instead of, there's still lots and lots of ways that the embeddedness of those norms in our structures of society are still very consequential and still influencing what parents, for example, do or what teachers do. But the fit of those traditional norms with the current opportunity structures in the society, it no longer works. And examples like the Me Too movement and the Title IX changes on college campuses with respect to sexual assault. You know, one of the interesting findings in an AAU study that was done a couple years ago, for example, was college males, 30% said that they would force a girl to have sex if they weren't afraid of getting caught.
Whoa.
That's the hanging on of that traditional conditioning in a modern context where that's no longer going to fly. And by and large, I think males understand that better and better. And we're all kind of struggling, groping really in the dark to adapt to a very changed world. So I think that the traditional reproduction of this historic masculinity has in fact already been disrupted to the point where a sociologist in Chicago identified gender vertigo as our characteristic condition. We're all trying to come up with new adaptations to the present modern world. But to your question, really, about where did it all come from, you know, I think it's important to say that boyhood was never designed for the sake of boys, and certainly hasn't been a particularly good fit with our human hearts and needs. I think that it's always been what one anthropologist described as a necessary but sacrificial condition. And, you know, the sacrifices that we males experience are profound. They're not just relational and emotional, but they're often, they often play out in terms of health and wellness, our very lives. The mortality rates at ages 15 to 29, premature and preventable deaths are 3 times male to female.
Michael, I wasn't going to ask this, but you've just set it up that I have to. And you've just talked about the sacrifices that men have made and make to fit into the current model. And of course, if you look at the genders, male, female, or the sexes, male, female, and then you sort of look at that gender component as well, the sacrifices that we can all point to and that are very obvious are those made by women through the ages. At least that's how my current understanding is. But I think you're right. There are profound sacrifices, and male, whatever maleness is, has been the sacrificial lamb in this case. But women experience it in a much more real way, in a much more real world way, a practical way. And why is it that women experience it in kind of that everyday way, but maybe not in the same ways as profoundly and deeply and emotionally as men, or maybe differently? Maybe they are. Well, of course they are emotionally. But there seems to be sort of an interesting dynamic between the sacrifice component between male and female and the struggles that each of us are facing today in the current cultural norm.
Yeah, you know, it's confusing whenever we try to do gender comparison, and we wind up almost in a competing victim claim mode. The truth is that in a patriarchal society, a society where male supremacy has been the norm, women have experienced, the short end of the stick for sure, excluded from lots and lots of opportunities and so forth. And we're still adjusting to a more gender-fair world in which girls and women are offered opportunities. There's been a transformation in my lifetime in that respect, and there's still lots of work to do. But that said, I think that because of the blessings of that women's movement, that gender equality movement, we're actually in a position today to be asking, what about the boys? What's going on with boyhood that we are seeing, you know, the kinds of the kinds of violations characterized, you know, by the Me Too movement? What's going on that a young man would think that forcing a girl, a woman, to have sex actually represents something satisfying and decent and good? You know, what's with that kind of desperation and narrowness, that myopia that some of those stories actually reflect? And we can trace the roots of those kinds of misconduct and misbehavior back to the kind of conditioning that takes place in boyhood, the way we cut young men off from their heart, from their relationships. We police them viciously, brutally, in peer bullying. We expose them to all kinds of crazy incitement and, encouragements to become dependent on alcohol or video games or pornography. You know, I lead an emotional literacy program at a boys' school outside of Philadelphia. And in that program, I'm just trying to hit key topics that are relevant to them and enable them to talk about not just what's going on for real, but what they feel about it as a way of practicing coding feelings with language and communicating about it. And one of the topics that we did most recently was pornography. And, you know, sure enough, every boy in the room acknowledged that the pornographic images that they see have an effect on them, mm-hmm. change them. And they often feel regret at how they notice those images resurfacing when they're actually trying to connect in some way romantically with a partner. So I guess the point I'm making is that, I don't think that the traditional gender equation has been beneficial on either side.
Great point. If you're just joining us, our guest is Dr. Michael Reichert. He's the founding director of the Center for the Study of Boys and Girls' Lives at the University of Pennsylvania. He's also a clinical practitioner who specializes in boys and men. He's conducted extensive research globally and has now written this book called How to Raise a Boy, The Power of Connection to Build Good Men. As you're talking, Michael, I can't help but remember these. It's been more than one or two instances in which I've heard fathers describe how they parent a young boy who's being bullied, for example, on the playground. And they start off by saying, well, use your words, tell them that's not okay. Then the next time it happens, walk away. They don't need to be your friend. And then it keeps happening. And finally, at about three or four times, they say, you know what, just turn around and punch him. And we would never say that to a young girl. Just turn around and punch him. So I'm wondering if, you know, ultimately there is the fact that boys are strong, they can dominate, you know, there's this testosterone that at some point begins to surge, and the physical ability to dominate is reinforced by instances like this. And yet you hear, you know, a dad or maybe even a mom retelling this story, and it's gotten traction because guess what finally worked when they turn around and punch the bully? And it just makes me think that, you know, this is where it turns, despite all of our best efforts as parents.
Yeah, Lynn, you're asking a lot as well in your question. You know, I think that it's important to acknowledge the realities of the dog-eat-dog nature of boyhood, of boy peer culture. Yeah, there's a lot of young men out there striving for dominance and hierarchy who are willing to put someone down in order to advance their own interests or their own standing. who are going to prove their masculinity at the expense of some other boy. And so we want our sons to be okay while we're building this better boyhood, this better world. We don't want our sons to be trampled over or steamrollered. We want our sons to be able to stand up for themselves and defend themselves as they need to in order to be okay. So generally what I think is we shouldn't necessarily be prescribing how our sons should respond to one thing or another happening in their peer culture. I actually think it's very difficult for adults to prescribe to the current generation because we're not there. We don't actually know what's possible or what the pressures are. We're too distant from it. I actually think our better course of action is to support and back our sons to think for themselves and to be able to operate independently as best they can of the peer norms and peer pressures to really be the kind of men that they want to be, not the kind of men they have to be in order to survive, or the kind of men that they think we want them to be. Again, I don't think we should be prescribing a certain outcome for our sons, except that they be themselves, that they be strong in their groundedness, in first to themselves, and then secondly to us. I think that the relationship, the connection between a boy and his caregiver, or his mentor, or his teacher, I think that's the real currency of human development. That's what allows a boy to be as fully himself, to be strong in his sense of himself. And that's the surest way that he's going to resist any pressure that tries to push him away from who he wants to be or who he really is.
Michael, I'm glad you brought that up, and I'm sure that this depends completely on your perspective, but there would be some that are resisting this disruption of cultural norms because it's the way they grew up and they pass it along to their kids. And as you pointed out in the very beginning of this conversation, we are at a moment in time for the first time in the history of humanity and culture and society where there's something different, available, and on offer. So let's talk about the positives of that. You've been examining boys and girls for a long time, and this disruption that is traumatic to some, I would view as very positive evolution, and it's coming in one generation where the father grew up in the traditional model and is very masculine by societal definition, and yet his child, whether it be male or female, is offered a different type of expression that was never available to that parent. Is that a good thing? Are you seeing that as a positive? And what's your take on it?
Yeah, I think that one of the theories of how we make progress historically from one generation to the next, one of the theories is that it happens at the level of our parenting, that each generation of parents does things a little bit better for their kids than their parents did it for them, that we make progress because we basically learn from the mistakes of the generation that raised us, and we try not to replicate those mistakes. I actually think that we can give ourselves some credit here. I think that while we might ourselves be rooted in sort of traditional ideas about being male, many of us dads actually want fuller lives for our sons. Many of us, many mothers want our sons to have healthy, respectful relationships with girls and women. And I think we're figuring out from one generation to the next how to do things better. And this current generation is experiencing, they certainly have experienced that revolution in gender equality and all of the ways that that changes everything in relationships, in opportunities, and so forth. So they're adapting to those changes, and they're drawing support for how they're adapting from their relationships with the generation that went before, many of us are kind of rooted in traditional, more traditional ideas. So we're all experiencing some degree of gender vertigo and uncertainty. But, you know, I think it's always been like that. I think historically, each generation has been at a cutting edge, breaking new ground. And I think that what we get to do in some ways is find confidence in our sons, the courage and the humanity of our children, and kind of put our faith there and let them lead us forward into the new world. That's what I think.
That's a great thought. How to Raise a Boy, the Power of Connection to Build Good Men. Our guest is Dr. Michael Reichert. And Michael, we've got to let you go, but I just wanted to mention, I mean, on the cover of your book, it's a couple of boys, young boys, who look like they're about 6 or 7. But this book is for parents of all boys, no matter what age. I'm quite convinced after having this conversation with you. Wouldn't you agree?
Absolutely. A lot of the stories in the inside the covers of that book are of boys, you know, who are much older than the boys on the cover. But what I think I like about the pictures on the front and the back covers are this sense of boys being themselves, being big and loud and noisy and exuberant.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think that really is who boys are when we're free to be ourselves.
Yes, absolutely. Well, a very nice book. And Michael Reichert, thank you so much for joining us today.
Nice talking with you, Lynn and Tim, and nice to be with your listeners.